with documents he was under criminal investigation. He's the only Koch brother who supports Donald Trump. And a couple of weeks after Donald Trump became president, his next-door neighbor at Mar-a-Lago, Bill Koch's criminal investigation suddenly stopped.
Finally, David K. Johnston, the first presidential debate is tonight. What question do you want to see raised about Donald Trump's taxes?
Oh, I think the biggest mistake Joe Biden could make would be to somehow attack wealth. That just doesn't sell in America. I think that what he should do is press him on, all right, the cat's out of the bag. You say it's fake news. Just show us your Form 1040s back to the year 2000. Why don't you just put out your Form 1040s? One of them's out. David K. Johnston published it 3 years ago. Just show those, and we'll see whether it's fake news or not. And Donald will dodge and parry about that. The emails I'm getting from people on the right are all designed to tell you that Joe Biden is a secret crook with a billion-dollar fortune, all of which is utter nonsense, by the way. This is a man who hadn't paid off his mortgage.
Well, David K. Johnston, I want to thank you for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, editor of DCReport.org. His most recent book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Tonight, we will be streaming the first presidential debate live, 9 Eastern Standard Time at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing
You're
on
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Easter Seals Walk With Me on Saturday, October 24th at 12 p.m., streaming online. Easter Seals is looking for volunteers to participate in their virtual fundraiser in support of their services for people with disabilities and their families. Again, that's Easter Seals Walk With Me on Saturday, October 24th at 12 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Do you believe in the importance of community radio?
Of course I do.
Then show your support today by donating online at kboo.fm and help us meet our fall fundraising goal of $80,000. We can only get there through the support of people like you. So donate at kboo.fm or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Give a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member today. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Protests in Portland against police brutality and racial injustice continued last night, with police using excessive amounts of mace and making 24 arrests. All evacuation orders in Clackamas County due to wildfires have been lifted, and Governor Kate Brown has extended the state's ban on residential evictions through the end of the year. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, September 29th, 2020. KABU is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Portland Black Lives Matter protests continued this week with reports of increased brutality and changes to police tactics. Monday night's protests began at Kenton Park in North Portland, with plans to gather and march to the nearby Police Association building on North Lombard Street. At around 9 p.m., 30 to 50 police circled and swept the park, searching for signs and shields. Multiple arrests were made, including a man who was registering people to vote online. Video footage shows the man refusing to give up his "Register to Vote Here" sign before police mace and arrest him. There was no declaration of an unlawful assembly. Official police communications justified the preemptive attack, calling the park, quote, "the initiation point of a planned unpermitted march." The official Twitter page for the Bureau also cited the confiscation of shields as necessary to prevent them from being used. This act of aggression comes days after an unpermitted Proud Boys rally occurred in Delta Park, where state and local police forces under unified command allowed armed far-right brawlers to assemble, assault press, and set up checkpoints in a public park. Protesters last night were not deterred from demonstrating. They walked to the Police Association building, taking sidewalks instead of the usual street march. Upon arrival, police declared the streets around the building open to traffic and the sidewalks surrounding it closed, leaving protesters with nowhere to legally assemble. 24 people were arrested in total last night, including members of the press and one of the organizers of this month's Wildfire Mutual Aid Hubs. An unlawful assembly was finally declared around midnight, with police threatening the use of tear gas, though Mayor Wheeler banned the use of the chemical last week. While CS gas was not deployed, multiple officers used excessive amounts of mace. Recent police escalation against protesters has renewed calls for accountability from activists and civil rights groups. Last night's officers did not wear identifying numbers as they have in the past. The numbers are said to protect the identities of officers, yet retain internal accountability. Those arrested last night will face misdemeanor charges, including disorderly conduct and interference with a peace officer, both of which are charges District Attorney Mike Schmidt says he will not pursue in court. It's unclear how many of the officers responding last night were among those police deputized by U.S. Marshals this weekend as part of the governor's response to the far-right rally in North Portland. Though Governor Brown's emergency order was lifted Sunday, the 56 members of Portland's Rapid Response Team and 22 state police also deputized will retain their federal status through the end of the year. Federal status allows officers to circumvent the temporary restraining order from use of force and the ban on CS gas. It also means federal charges for protesters arrested for interfering with these officers. It is unclear what accountability measures are in place for these officers, whose past actions have prompted the very regulations against force, which no longer apply to them. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 299 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 33,291. Oregon health officials also reported 8 new deaths, raising the state's death toll up to 555 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Tuesday, with 52, followed by Marion County with 49, and Washington County with 41 cases. Nationally, more than 7.2 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the coronavirus. At least 205,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there have been an average of 42,000 cases per day, an increase of 15% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 33.4 million people in nearly every country. As of Tuesday afternoon, more than 1 million people have died across the world. On Monday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown issued a new ban on residential evictions from September 30th through December 31st. The state's current moratorium on residential and commercial evictions is set to expire on Wednesday, September 30th. Brown's new order extends Oregon's ban on non-payment residential evictions through the end of the year. Brown said the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and the devastation caused by historic wildfires in Oregon as reasons to continue the eviction ban. Brown said in a statement, quote, "Housing is a critical human need, and as we enter cold and flu season during a pandemic, and as many students learn remotely from school, it is absolutely critical that people not be turned out of their homes." The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office announced on Tuesday that all evacuation areas in the county have been eliminated and returned to normal, except in parts of the U.S. National Forest. The evacuation level reduction took effect at 10 a.m. Some residents will now be allowed to return home for the first time in weeks. The U.S. National Forest is still closed in the Clackamas River District, and there are partial closures to the Zigzag Ranger District. According to county officials, before the order took effect, about 1,100 homes were under a Level 3 evacuation order, and a few thousand more were under a Level 2 order. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has locations set up in Clackamas, Lincoln, Linn, and Marion counties to help people directly affected by wildfires in the state. The Lion's Head Fire remains the largest wildfire burning in Oregon at 204 acres. Containment is at 34%, but fire officials say they are seeing good progress. The Beachy Creek Fire, north of Detroit, spans 192 acres and is 58% contained. Officials said no significant fire growth is expected. The Holiday Farm Fire in Lane County is 173 acres and is now 60% contained. The east wind, coupled with hot weather, is expected to create small columns of smoke over the next few days. The Riverside Fire near Estacada is 138 acres and remains 37% contained. Wildfires in the state have forced mass evacuations, caused hazardous air quality across the region, and led to the death of 9 people. The Oregon Health Authority issued a public health advisory on Tuesday because of higher than normal levels of fecal bacteria in the ocean at Seaside Beach. Oregon health officials are warning people to avoid direct contact with the water at Seaside until the advisory is lifted. People should also avoid wading in nearby creeks, pools of water on the beach, or discolored water. They also warned people to stay clear of any water runoff flowing into the ocean. The increased bacteria levels can come from stormwater runoff, sewer overflows, failing septic systems, and animal waste from livestock, pets, and wildlife. Contact with high levels of fecal bacteria can cause diarrhea, stomach cramps, skin rashes, upper respiratory infections, and other illnesses. The state health authority said that other recreational activities at the beach, such as walking, flying kites, or having a picnic, are fine and are not impacted by the health advisory. The New York Times has uncovered information regarding Donald Trump's income taxes. Here's KBOO's Al Kahn with the story.
The New York Times has uncovered information on Donald Trump's taxes, dating back to over 2 decades, which revealed he paid only $750 in 2016 and the same amount again in 2017. The data also shows that he didn't pay taxes at all in 10 of the last 15 years, due to reporting monetary losses much greater than his income. Trump has refused to disclose his tax records for the entire length of his time in office, and this new information goes a long way to explaining why. The data obtained by the Times shows a much different story than that of a man who became a successful businessman making hundreds of millions each year, when in fact, the records show, he has been faced with debilitating losses, which has put him in a position where he is dependent on income from resources that may put him in conflict with his duties as president. Trump also appears to have between $300 and $400 million in loans, which he personally guaranteed, which are soon to come due. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi weighed in on all of this, asking who Trump owed these debts to, suggesting they might be owed to different countries, and called into question that they may be used to leverage Trump's actions, and then calling it a national security issue. Trump has called the New York Times article fake news, and blasted the media on Twitter, calling the information illegally obtained, and accused the Times of bad intent. The newspaper responded the information obtained was from sources who had legal access to it. Trump is the first president since the 1970s not to release his tax information. Meanwhile, his rival for the Oval Office, Joe Biden, who he will debate tonight, has released his returns which show he paid almost $300,000 in taxes last year. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
Nationwide, more than 100 small-scale farms disappeared between 2011 and 2018. Small farmers say federal policies are sidestepping rural communities. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Small farmers and rural residents say Washington has for too long neglected the special needs of these regions, and some are now calling on lawmakers to establish a National Office of Rural Prosperity. Craig Watts is a farmer and farm advocate and a consultant for the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project. He says over the past several decades, policy decisions have consolidated the agriculture sector and left America's small-scale family farms with lower prices, fewer choices, and huge debts to pay for essential supplies, such as seeds and fertilizer.
We're in an industrial-type system now that is not sustainable. We have to get some policy changes because the policies right now are what is driving this system and is putting the small farmers out of business.
But Watt says farmers comprise less than 10% of the rural workforce. He says a National Office of Rural Prosperity could work to address the unique structural challenges of rural housing, education, health care, small business development, and job creation. Matt Hildreth of the group RuralOrganizing.org says current federal funding for rural programs is scattered across different agencies. He says that means money often doesn't end up in the places where it could have the most impact.
Right now, when you look at the federal government, the rural programs are through USDA, they're through HUD, they're through all these different agencies, and there's really no unified central force that's focused on keeping rural dollars rural.
Federal programs for economic development in small towns and rural communities only received $3.5 billion this year. Hildreth says that's just pennies compared with the $50 billion given to industrial farms. According to RuralOrganizing.org's recent poll of more than 7,000 rural battleground voters, only 1 in 10 rural voters thinks USDA programs benefit small farms and small towns. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, featuring an interview with Oregon-based natural resource economist Ernie Niemi, focusing on the economic impact Oregonians should expect as the climate warms. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 86 degrees. Today in history, in 2008, the Dow Jones Industrial Average falls by 777 points, at the time the largest single-day point loss in its history. The Dow drop equaled a $1.2 trillion loss in market value, contributing to the 18-month-long Great Recession. The quote of the day is from author and social activist Gloria Jean Watkins, better known by her pen name Bell Hooks, who said, quote, "All our silences in the face of racist assault are acts of complicity." The first debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump is being held tonight. For more, here's KBOO's Al Kahn.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden are set to square off tonight in the first of three scheduled debates. Tonight's event will be held at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, and will be moderated by Chris Wallace. The debate will be held in front of a sparse audience of about 70 people, all of which will receive testing for COVID-19 and will be wearing masks and practicing social distancing. The debate is scheduled to last 90 minutes without commercial interruption and will be divided into 15-minute sections on topics which include the records of each band, the Supreme Court, COVID-19, the economy, race and violence in our cities, and the integrity of the election. Biden is expected to use newly released information from the New York Times regarding Trump's tax returns as a weapon against Trump. Trump, meanwhile, has denounced this as fake news and most likely will attempt to call out the media's liars. The Trump campaign so far has been trying to paint a picture of Biden as senile and not up to the job, spending millions in advertising dollars trying to plant into voters' minds that he is mentally unfit. Trump has also taken Twitter to explain away a strong Biden performance in advance by accusing Biden of using drugs to enhance his capability. Biden has showed in the past that he is skillful on the debate stage and usually appears poised and relaxed, often smiling at some of his opponent's misstatements. Trump, on the other hand, often appears aggressive while debating, to the point of being brash, often interrupting his opponents and throwing out accusations of falsehood when he feels threatened. Currently, Biden leads by 8 percentage points in national polls, and a strong performance tonight could possibly widen this gap. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Today is the first presidential debate taking place in Cleveland, Ohio, and a British news show reports a Trump campaign effort to suppress the black vote in 2016. With more on the story, it's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
More people identify their support as unwavering at this particular time than 4 years ago.
And more Americans than ever before have already voted early, making tonight's first presidential debate in Cleveland one of the few remaining opportunities to reach undecided voters, says Ed Lee, debate expert at Emory University. Lee expects the New York Times investigation into 2 decades of Trump tax returns will get a lot of attention.
If more people are talking about the fact that President Trump only paid $750 in taxes during the first year of his administration, I think that Joe Biden would have won this debate.
Top Republican lawmakers were quiet yesterday on news of Trump's chronic losses, massive debt, and failure to pay any income taxes in 10 of the 15 years before taking office. Not so Mark Ranneberger with Republicans and Independents for Biden, a Lincoln Project initiative.
Republicans like low taxes. What they don't like is a tax cheat.
Conservationists are calling for debate about climate change missing from moderators' questions in 2016. With worsening wildfires in the West and supercharged hurricanes in the Southeast, Colin O'Mara with the National Wildlife Federation says the issue can't be ignored.
To not have a question is just the height of irresponsibility. We think that every American has a right to know what the candidates' positions are on these incredibly important issues that are affecting, you know, millions of their neighbors across the country.
Senator Kamala Harris debates Vice President Mike Pence early next month. Yesterday in North Carolina, she listed 3 major rollbacks at stake if Trump's Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed: healthcare, reproductive rights, and protecting the vote.
Right here in North Carolina, a voter suppression law was described by a federal court as having targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision.
Barrett's a former member of the Federalist Society, which is funded by conservative mega donors, including Robert Mercer. Barrett was added to Trump's shortlist less than a year after he appointed her to her first judgeship. Another one of Mercer's investments is again in the news, Cambridge Analytica, the infamous British firm that misused private information on millions of Facebook users. With data obtained from the now bankrupt company, a British news show reported that the Trump campaign targeted millions of black voters in battleground states in 2016, using personalized data with misleading Facebook ads to deter them from voting. Cambridge Analytica has since closed down, but its operations continue under Emmer Data Limited, with ongoing ties to the Mercer family. Jessica Gonzalez with Free Press wants Congress to do more to protect private data.
We can do something about invasion of our privacy rights. We can do something about targeted efforts to keep black people and other people of color away from the polls. Those are things we can and should legislate around.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks to Eric Galatis from Colorado News Connection, and thanks for listening.
Tribes push back on plans to roll back protections in Tongass National Forest, and the Pasquayaki tribe calls on Pima County to reinstate an early voting site on the reservation. With that story and more, It's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native tribes are pushing back on the Trump administration's plan to fully roll back the roadless rule in Alaska's Tungus National Forest. Jacob Resnick reports.
The roughly 17 million acres in southeast Alaska make up the largest national forest in the U.S. It's home to the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian peoples who rely on it for subsistence. Tribes were particularly vocal about keeping the national forest intact.
We really don't want any more industrial logging.
Joel Jackson is president of the Organized Village of Cake.
Old growth timber areas provide for us going out to gather berries and our medicines and also hunt the deer and moose in our area.
The Forest Service received around 411,000 comments, most of them urging it to keep the roadless rule protections in place. Alaskans in public hearings also overwhelmingly delivered the same message. Jackson says the agency was just going through the motions over the past 2 years.
I felt like they didn't really listen, and it turned out they didn't.
The agency was listening to some. Emails obtained through the Freedom of Information Act revealed an Alaska timber trade group sat in on a telephone call between Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy and U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue last year. The call had been arranged by a D.C. timber industry lobbyist. That revelation angered tribal leaders. President Joel Jackson says attempts at meeting the agriculture secretary in D.C. were rebuffed.
They're just a timber association, and the tribes are sovereign nations, every one of us. So that really upset me that we were brushed aside.
Ecologists are alarmed at the prospect of as much as 168,000 acres of old-growth trees could eventually be logged. The forest is a carbon sink, whose importance, they say, can't be understated.
The Tungus is the last temperate rainforest that is actually the lungs of the United States now.
Once the rule is finalized next month, it won't be simple to reverse. A future presidential administration would need to restart the multi-year rulemaking process to restore protections to Tungus National Forest. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Alaska.
The Pascua Yaqui tribe in southern Arizona has sent a demand letter to its county recorder as it attempts to reinstate the early voting site within its reservation before the upcoming election. Emma Gibson with Arizona Public Media has more.
The Pima County Recorder's Office informed the tribe it would be closing the site within its 2,000-acre reservation near Tucson about a month before the 2018 primary election. Over the last 2 years, Pascua Yaqui leaders like Tribal Council member Herminia Frias have tried to advocate, negotiate, and gather support to make early voting easier for members living in the reservation.
I don't understand how we continue to have this issue in this day where early voting, where it's supposed to be accessible, is not.
Voting advocates say those living in the reservation have lower car ownership than the general public, so a trip to the closest early voting site now means 2 hours on public transportation. The tribe's chairman says by denying members in the reservation a convenient place to vote early, the recorder's actions are as good as voter suppression. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
Throughout Pima County, early voting begins as early as next week. Leaders of three Native organizations will provide updates to U.S. lawmakers on COVID-19 response in Indian Country. A hearing is scheduled Wednesday in a subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee to gather testimony from witnesses with the National Congress of American Indians, the National Indian Health Board, and the National Council of Urban Indian Health. The hearing will be live streamed. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Samantha Lau. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bulkey, Antonia Gonzalez, and Nadia Romlagon. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We're currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, featuring an interview with Oregon-based natural resource economist Ernie Neamey about the range of economic impacts Oregonians should expect as the climate warms.
Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew Collins Anderson, and I'm the host of Coast Range Radio. The Coast Range Association works to build just and sustainable communities that provide for people in the natural world. We believe a better world is possible. Visit our website, coastrange.org, to hear past episodes of this show and to learn about the Coast Range Association's forests and climate change work. If you want to get involved or learn more, you can email me at andrew@coastrange.org. This is a special episode of Coast Range Radio. In this interview, we are on location with natural resource economist Ernie Neamey. Ernie is the co-founder and co-director of the Forest Carbon Coalition, forestcarboncoalition.org, and founder of Natural Resource Economics, Incorporated. I'll let Ernie provide some more detail on his background and his field of natural resource economics.
I am a native Oregonian. I grew up in rural eastern Oregon outside of Klamath Falls. Got my baccalaureate degree at the University of Oregon. I went overseas and worked as a Peace Corps teacher in eastern Africa. Came back. I lived in Roseburg. I worked for the timber industry. I worked for Coos Kerry and Douglas counties to work on their economic problems at that time. Went back and got a graduate degree and came back and worked in Oregon, in Eugene, as a consulting economist looking at the intersection between communities and families and their economic strengths and the natural resources in which we live. What are the interactions in the timber industry? How does that work? What are the benefits? What are the costs? What are the impacts, the relationships to salmon, to clean water in our rivers, to clean drinking water, to clean air, to healthy forests? So it's trying to understand the importance of natural resources. And I use that word very carefully rather than the economic value, because when you talk to most people about what is the value of something, they think about the price. And so many of our natural resources don't have a price attached to them because we don't buy and sell them in the grocery store, but they are still extremely important to us. And so natural resource economists have tried to help us better understand how important is healthy air, how important is clean water. We know, for example, that the scientists will tell us that if you raise children near a freeway, those children have a higher risk of being sick. Well, how important is that? Economists come in and help figure that out. We know that if we cut down trees and carbon dioxide is released into the air, The scientists can measure and have measured how much carbon dioxide. The economist's job is to say, how important is that? And what we found is it's really, really important if you live in Western Oregon, where we have the best tree-growing land in the world. So that's what natural resource economists do. That's what I have done in my career.
Fantastic. And so you've recently published a paper, a working paper titled Bigger Than Expected. Could you give a brief background of what that is and why you put this paper out there?
Yes. When I started my career, most of my work looked down. We looked at the soil, we looked at the water, we looked at the trees. More recently, we've looked up at climate change, at the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases going up. And so I've been following the science of this and what the implications are when you integrate the economics and the science, what the expected impacts are going to be, what the expected costs of carbon dioxide emissions are going to be. More recently, especially in the last year, the science has changed. And so we have more than 11,000 scientists last year signed a letter that said the climate crisis is materializing faster than scientists expected, and it is more severe than scientists expected. We have other research that feeds into those conclusions. So what I have done is said that the climate disaster costs are going to be bigger than expected, and that's the report that I prepared. Now, the flip side of that is that the climate disaster benefits of reducing carbon dioxide emissions are going to be bigger. So the report is an attempt to help people, and especially Oregonians, understand what are these catastrophes, what are these disasters, and how important are they that are coming our direction, as well as to help us evaluate and compare actions that we might take to reduce emissions and reduce those future climate disasters. That report is available on a website that is run by the Forest Carbon Coalition. It's FCC, forestcarboncoalition.org. We know, for example, that the forests in America hold enough carbon that is equal to about more than 50 years of our carbon emissions, and that each year the amount of carbon stored in Oregon, in America's forests grows by about equivalent to more than two more years of emissions. Mm. So our forests are tremendously important in if America, if Oregonians are going to get a handle on and reduce these climate disasters.
Excellent. Where do the economics come into these considerations and how it has been put together in this report?
Well, one of the beauties of the science regarding climate change is that it is so diverse. So we have scientists who are looking at Antarctic ice. We are looking at insects. We're looking at diseases moving out of the tropics and moving northward into the temperate climates. We're looking at the impacts on forests, on water, on droughts, on food production, and on all of these things. And so it's sort of a mystery. How do you wrap your head around this and say, what's really going, how do I understand all of this? How do I weigh ice with insects? Well, that's what economics can do. We can't do all of it yet, but we can do two things. First of all, we can say, how big is the overall impact of climate disasters coming your direction? So we can look at, NOAA, for example, has looked at what were the overall impacts, state by state, of the largest of the climate disasters in 2018. The impacts in Oregon, even though we didn't have any of these impact, these disasters in our state, we still saw that the reduction in our economic production, gross domestic product, was equivalent to up to $750 per household. We also can look at the science from the impacts on food production, the impacts from wildfires, the impacts from it's too hot to be out and work. And we can see that what Oregonians ought to be expecting is that these climate costs coming in our direction are at least $15,000 per household per year sometime in the next couple of decades or so. It could be next year for some of these. It could be some of them won't materialize for several decades. Well, economics can provide a yardstick for the cost coming in our direction. The second thing that we can do is economists can use a tool called the social cost of carbon dioxide, or the cost that carbon dioxide imposes on society. And we can use that tool to help evaluate different actions that we might take to reduce climate disaster risks. So we can compare, for example, what are the potential benefits of planting a million trees versus the potential benefits of allowing industrial trees grow an additional 15 years to what are the potential benefits of reducing our vehicle miles traveled by 1%. We can use that tool to help provide households. How do you want to reduce your costs? Or we can help provide that information to the governor and the legislature if they want to listen. And so far they're only interested in taking teeny tiny steps. But maybe eventually, if enough people say, look, for every $1 million that we produce of goods and services, of the benefits of our economic activities, we are producing about the same level of climate disaster costs. That's just insane. And it's insane for our own lives. It's insane for the lives of our children and future generations. How can we do this?
And that's a major finding in this report.
Major finding in this report. So that's how we put this into context at a general scale for the state as a whole.
Yeah.
When they then scale down to look at individual types of actions. Well, first of all, consider where do most of the emissions come from? Most Oregonians, I think, understand that emissions coming from the burning of fossil fuels are especially important because that's where a lot of the carbon dioxide comes from. And that's exactly correct. About one quarter of our emissions comes from burning gasoline and diesel in cars and trucks. That's about one quarter of our emissions. One third of our emissions, however, even more important, are the emissions that come from logging. One way to think about this is that our timber industry is equivalent to the coal industry that we see in Kentucky and Ohio back east. That we have a natural resource, trees, that have pulled carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. When we cut those trees down, most of that carbon dioxide goes back into the atmosphere. In effect, these trees, if we left them alone for millions of years, they would become coal. So it's just an intermediate step in terms of coal. What we find is that the land in Western Oregon is some of the best land in the world for growing trees that are able to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. When we cut them down, then we have some of the largest impacts in the world in terms of the social costs resulting from logging. So about one third of our emissions come from the timber industry. Now, that's equivalent to about every acre that we log generates social costs of more than $500,000.
Per acre.
Per acre. Because we have the carbon dioxide sitting in the trees, mm-hmm. we cut it down, we burn the slash, we burn a lot of the sawdust and the like when we process the trees. A lot of that wood in the tree is converted, say, into paper, which then goes into the landfill, it rots, and the carbon dioxide goes up. Most of the carbon dioxide in those trees that we cut down ends up in the atmosphere pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's some that is stored, but...
There's some that is stored, but not an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, just to put it in context, it could be, if we look at the high-risk estimate of the social cost, that it's more than $500,000 per acre. It's more than $140 per log truck. Now, what's also important is that if we look at the climate damages resulting from logging, and we compare it to the revenues, because we know that people cut down trees in order to get money. So if we look at state lands where we have the most information, if we look at the carbon dioxide emissions and the climate disaster damages resulting from those emissions, those damages exceed the state's revenues by at least more than 10 to 1 and probably more than 50 to 1. So every dollar that the state receives by cutting timber in the Elliott State Forest or in the Tillamook State Forest or up in Clatsop, the climate damages are perhaps more than 50 times larger than that. That is just insanity from an economic perspective.
Yes.
You don't do things where the costs exceed the benefits, because that makes you worse off. You do things only where the benefits exceed the costs. So I'm not saying that you don't do any logging whatsoever. I'm saying that when you're logging and the costs exceed the benefits by 50 to 1, that's an insane thing to do. That harms us right now, and it certainly harms our children and our grandchildren and future generations.
When you're talking about these emissions, is that just the forest, just the trees, or does that include the machinery, the gas used?
No, it's just the trees.
Wow.
It is just the trade-off. If you let trees grow, they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. If you cut them down, you release that carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So it's not taking into account the diesel that you have to burn in order to have the trucks go out mm-hmm. and pick up the logs and carry them into the mill. Doesn't count the diesel and fossil fuels that are burned in the mill. None of that. It is just simply looking at the importance of trees, and especially trees in Western Oregon.
And you brought up a really important piece there, the recent studies that have been coming out, and past studies about how the value of the Coast Range Pacific Northwest forests are per acre so much more for carbon storage than other types of forests. They're high priority forests.
Anywhere in the world. So it's not just in Oregon,
no.
Not just in the United States, North America, it's anywhere in the world. We have the jewel of forests and forest lands right here in Oregon. Now, part of what this tells us then, so what do you do? Well, one implication is that you let trees grow longer. And if you let trees grow longer, it doesn't mean you don't ever cut them down, because at some point we do need to have the lumber and wood products from those. But if, for example, you let them grow an additional 5 years, you pull more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. You let them grow an additional 10 years before you cut them down, additional 15 years. Well, we have about 6 million acres of industrial lands. These mm-hmm. are the lands that are clear cut all around the hills that you can see when you're driving around Oregon right now.
Yes.
If the timber industry permanently allowed those trees to grow an additional 15 years before they cut them down, we would reduce Oregon's industrial timberlands would reduce future carbon disasters by almost $1 trillion. Almost $1 trillion.
Wow.
Simply by letting our trees grow an additional 15 years before we cut them down.
Wow, just 15 years.
Well, it's not. It is every year you let them grow 15 years longer,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
so that at any given point we have trees that are 15 years older than you otherwise would be for the next 100 years and beyond.
I see.
Right, so it's not just
the rotation
years.
Cycles.
It's the rotation cycle. Yeah. Implemented over a long period of time, over time will reduce climate disasters by that amount.
Wow.
So it's not just within the next, by 2035.
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Now, another thing that we can do is we can plant trees. If you look back at old maps, for example, the Willamette Valley was covered in trees.
Hmm.
When you had the first survey done of the Willamette Valley, it was just trees from the Coast Range to the Cascades. We've cut most of those down. We have houses, we have backyards, we have coarse pastures, we have large croplands growing grass seed or whatever. Now, if we went out and we planted, say, 1 million trees, which sounds like a lot, but it really isn't.
Mm-mm.
You'll put an additional tree in your backyard, put 4 or 5 trees in the horse pasture out in suburban Clackamas County, what have you, planted 1 million trees, what we would find is that over time, those trees would pull enough carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that each year the reduction in climate disasters would be about $7 per tree. Well, so we would get about $7 million worth of reduction in climate disaster damages from planting 1 million trees and letting them grow.
And that's over that time, so it's not the first year. It's not $7.
No, and this is one of the this is one of the myths that pro-logging folks want people to mislead people, is that they cut down a very big tree and they replace it with a little bitty tree, and they say that little bitty tree grows really fast, and that's true. Little bitty trees do grow fast, but they're little bitty. So they really don't pull very much carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Whereas a very large tree doesn't grow in percentage terms very fast, but it's really big. So it's pulling an awful lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as it grows slowly. The research on these issues has been completed around the world. The research that I am depending upon, to a great extent, comes out of Corvallis, out of Oregon State University. Mm. We have had at that university some of the leading scientific researchers on these issues in the world. And so they have looked at what has happened in Oregon's forests. They have documented why these forests are so important worldwide, why they are better than forests anywhere else in the world. And then they have looked at what are the emissions that the logging industry generates when it goes out and implements its current practices. They have documented that the timber industry represents about one-third of Oregon's total emissions. They were the first to document that. You know, that is the best research that's ever been completed anywhere else in the world. Again, these are the leading researchers. I've used that then to say, here's the impact per acre, or the impact per all of Oregon's timber industry. You then multiply that, simple arithmetic, times the cost per metric ton of carbon dioxide that results from logging, and presto, you come up with what is the additional climate disaster damages that is caused by our current logging practices. Or alternatively, what are the reductions in future climate damages that our children will face if we modified our logging practices so we didn't emit so much carbon dioxide from our trees? What we've seen in Oregon already is that the major climate disasters, those that generated costs of more than $1 billion each, in the United States, in 2018, well, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they have a map on their website that shows where those occurred. None of them occurred in Oregon. And yet the impacts on Oregon's economy reduced our output of goods and services by up to $750 per household. That means that each household had a reduced ability to go to work, produce goods and services to sell to other parts of the United States and around the world, perhaps up to $750 per household. It's very easy to go onto the internet. You can find the scientific literature that says, what do we expect for increases in food costs? What it says is that we should be expecting increases of 15 to 20% by about the middle of this century. That was the expected impact.
Yes.
What the new science says, it's going to be worse than expected. Well, the expected impact of a 20% increase in food costs translates into a cost of more than $1,000 per household in Oregon. We know that as we see these disasters cripple economic activity in the United States, around the world, that economic output goes down. The demand for goods and services produced in Oregon goes down. We should expect that that reduction in worldwide economic activity will have impacts on Oregon of perhaps $3,000 reduced income per household. Workers will not be able to earn as much income. We see that, especially here in Oregon and on the West Coast, we should expect more wildfires. Some households will see their homes burn. Some communities will spend an awful lot of money to fight the fire right on the edges of the community. We also know that that smoke can move from California, it can move from British Columbia and come into the Willamette Valley, come into Oregon. And when we are exposed to high levels of wildfire smoke, some people can't breathe. They go to the hospital.
Yeah.
That's a cost. Some people die. We know that children are supposed to not go outside and play, and so parents have to not go to work, but instead stay home and take care of the children to keep them indoors. We know that some people who work outside will be told that they shouldn't go outside and work. So we look at all of that, and the literature tells us that Oregonians should be expecting that the costs from wildfires in Oregon, from the fires themselves and from exposure to smoke, could be as high as $8,000 per household on average in the next 10 to 20 years. It could be next year if we have a really severe wildfire year. But we know that what the science is telling us is that these wildfires are coming faster than we expected and are going to be more severe than we expected. We also know from the science, it's easy to find, Oregon Health Authority has information there on the number of people who die from high temperatures, heat waves in Oregon. And the expectation is that sometime in the next several decades was the expectation is that about 250 additional people per year on average would die from heat waves. But the science of the last year or so, scientists have started to tell us that it's going to be worse than expected. So we could expect those 250 additional deaths to occur more rapidly than the middle of the century. It could be next year that we see that if next year is an extremely hot year. So the costs are coming to Oregon, the costs from our own actions of emitting greenhouse gases, and the costs from other people around the world emitting greenhouse gases. If all of us continue to emit them, we all start to see these catastrophic disasters. Let's reduce the activities that generate an awful lot of emissions. Around the world, let's not produce as much coal, let's not burn as much coal. Let's not produce as much oil, let's not burn as much gasoline and diesel. Here in Oregon, let's not log as many trees. Let more trees grow bigger, plant more trees so that they can grow bigger and reduce the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So what that means then is that we need to reduce logging. All right, that's going to have impacts for some workers. Let's be really candid about how many workers that is and what's happening for those workers that will be adversely affected. What we know is that the timber industry is ruthless in its search for ways to get rid of workers. So when we had the Great Recession in the 2007-2011 period, during that period, the timber industry reduced its output. It was a recession, so they didn't make as many 2x4s, but they've bounced back. They are now producing as many 2x4s as they did before the Great Recession. They have eliminated 1/3 of their workforce during that period. They are going to continue to do that, substituting new technologies for labor. So let's be very concerned about those workers, whether the industry lays them off or whether they get laid off because we want to reduce emissions. Let's have solid worker training. Let's bring new jobs so that workers can find those jobs and so that employers can find trained workers. That means we invest in our community colleges to give people skills. Yeah. Community colleges are tremendous institutions, many of them out in away from our urban centers. Let's look at what we need to do in order to grow healthy trees, right? We have forests that are not very healthy. Let's go out and try to make them better. We know that we are losing salmon because, in large part, because we have clear cuts that make the water in streams very hot,
yes,
hotter than salmon can tolerate.
Yes.
And in late summer, there's no water there at all. So let's try to invest in how do we save our really important keystone species, such as salmon. When we save more salmon, there will be more jobs on the coast and along rivers that are oriented towards salmon. So there are an awful lot of things that we can do. It just requires that we pay attention to workers rather than paying attention to corporate earnings. And that's a big shift. We pay attention to workers. We pay attention to resources being managed to the benefit of workers and communities rather than being managed to the benefit of Wall Street corporations. I think we need to have somebody in the governor's office.
Yeah.
I think we need to have these programs that you have going on out in the Coast Range and communities to help people understand. Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah.
We're committed to you.
Yeah.
We're not just committed to fish, we're committed to you as well.
That's such a huge piece, and it gets missed in a lot of the...
Yes, it does.
Ernie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crossing Boundaries, virtual fishing derby and auction from Saturday, September 26th through Sunday, October 4th, streaming online. This fundraiser for